You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
This is a last gamble song. The end of a 100-year wars. The voices sound sad as they're singing along. Another piece of America's lost.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal and I'm an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Joining us today is Danny Anderson, assistant professor of English at Mount Aloysius College in Crescent, Pennsylvania. Danny, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back. It's a lot of fun always.
Hey, you are welcome anytime. Nice. I suppose Ed's not here, so I shouldn't give a firm commitment to that, but I think that's fairly reasonable. And the guy that we can't refuse to come on the show, Michael Farmer, assistant professor of English at Crown College in St. Bonifacius, Minnesota. Michael, how you doing?
I'm good. Semester's over, and I know this probably won't air until April, so it'll be a sad joke when I say the semester's over. But as we're recording, the semester's over, and I'm in a good mood.
I mean, you never know.
As good a mood as I'm ever in, to be fair.
We'll go for a month without dropping anything, and then we'll drop like 7 episodes in a week, so... Who knows? Who knows when this will drop?
Fair enough.
Well, as you can tell by our list of panelists today, we are back on the country music kick. And I want to start us off before we get into the main topic for today with sort of an introductory question. What is the worst country music song of all time? Danny, what do you got?
I really hate – I don't know that I always hated it, but I've come to hate – the Christy Lane song, One Day at a Time, Sweet Jesus.
One day at a time, sweet Jesus. That's all I'm asking from you. Just give me the strength to do every day what I have to do. Yesterday's gone. And tomorrow may never be mine. Lord, help me today. Show me the way, one day at a time. Do you remember when you walked among men? Well, Jesus, you know, if you're looking below, it's worse now than then. Cheating and stealing, violence and crime. So for my faith, teach me to take one day.
That's all I'm asking from you. It was sung at my aunt's funeral, by my mom, actually.
Jeez, think about it.
and then I just realized lyrically, like, how terrible that song is about Jesus looking down from heaven and looking at today and realizing it's worse now than it was back when you lived, when people literally hung people on sticks and let them out to die over a series of days. But it's much worse now, right? And so, I just find it the whiniest, like, self-pitying form of like depression music that masks as like Christian country music, and I detest that song.
I guess I hadn't thought of it that way, but it is kind of Jesus looking down and saying, "Gosh, you're having a bad day, aren't you?"
Yeah.
I don't know that song. I'm sorry.
He's like, I really feel sorry for you.
Yeah. It is a terrible song. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt about that. But it's, I don't know if I'd say it's the worst. It's just, it's a terrible.
Well, it's the one that came to mind. Sure. I'm sure there's a million other like 80s pop country songs that I could have gone to, but that's the one that came to mind. It's truly abysmal for theological reasons.
Right, and I should have said, you know, excluding the gimmicks and the terrible parodies, you know, anything by Cletus T. Judd should automatically be excluded from this list.
Anyone named Cletus, really. So
I think Cletus T. Judd is kind of funny.
He is kind of funny, but I mean, yeah, he's as good as a Weird Al knockoff could ever possibly be.
Yeah, as good as the hillbilly Weird Al Yankovic.
Yeah. Well, my answer to that was the song Teddy Bear by Red Sovine. I don't know if you guys know that one or not, but it's a trucker song.
I was on the outskirts of a little southern town, trying to reach my destination before the sun went down. The old CB was blaring away on channel 19 when there came a little boy's voice on the radio line. And he said, "Breaker 19, is anyone there? Come on back, truckers, and talk to Teddy Bear." Well, I keyed the mic and I said, "You got it, Teddy Bear." And the little boy's voice came back on the air. "Appreciate the break. Who we got on that end?" I told him my handle and then he began. "Now, I'm not supposed to bother you fellas out there. Mom says you're busy and for me to stay off there. But you see, I get lonely and it helps to talk. 'Cause that's about all I can do. I'm crippled and I can't walk." I came back and told him to fire up that mic, and I'd talk to him as long as he liked. "This was my dad's radio," the little boy said.
It's I think it's spoken, it's not sung at all, though there's the instrumental in the background. And this trucker hears on his CB radio a little boy's voice coming across, and the boy tells about how his dad was killed and he's crippled and his mom's having to work full time, and his dad was a trucker and he loves trucks. So all of these truckers show up at this kid's house, because apparently the kid gives his address out over the airwaves, and they all give him rides in the truck and then leave a bunch of money for the mom. And that's the plot. I mean, as far as the plot goes. With that said, I do have a good memory.
I have not one but two novelty Christmas songs by Red Sovine, by the way. They're both about trucking.
I think all of his songs were about trucking.
Whatever happened to the trucker song?
And they're always spoken words. Remember Convoy? I forget the guy who sang
that's
that.
That's C.W. McCall.
Who is not a real person, but in fact the guy from Mannheim Steamroller, speaking of Christmas songs.
Interesting.
Really, that's Chip Davis?
Yeah. Yeah,
I did.
C.W. McCall is a character created for a radio spot, I believe.
How interesting! Yeah,
I had no idea. Well, Michael, what do you have for a worst country song?
I think it has to be a bro country song. It has to be something sung by somebody who wears a leather hat. So I was thinking "Some Beach" by Blake Shelton, but as I keep thinking about it, I think "Indian Outlaw" by Tim McGraw, which is kind of the bro country song. I think that has to be one of the worst songs ever written.
I'm an Indian outlaw, half Cherokee and Choctaw. My baby, she's a Chippewa, she's a one of a kind. All my friends call me Bear Claw. The village chicken is my pawpaw. He gets his orders from my mama. She makes him walk the line. You can find me in my wigwam. I'll be beating on my tom-tom. Pull out the pipe and smoke you some. Hey, and pass it around. 'Cause I'm an Indian outlaw, half Cherokee and Choctaw. My baby, she's a Chippewa, she's a one of a kind.
It's offensive, it's stupid, it launches the career of Tim McGraw, who definitely changes country music for the worse. I'm going with Indian Outlaw.
So where I grew up, that song played, I don't know, probably every 30 minutes on the radio.
They just chain played it?
Pretty much. Certainly at every athletic event when I was in school, that song was played. Once I switched schools off the reservation, then it was less common to bump into that. But
so Native Americans like that song?
They, at least when it came out. I cannot speak to whether or not they still like it. But, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, whenever it was that it came out, yes. It was... I mean, how many songs were there being written in the early 90s about Native Americans in the first place?
Seminole Wind by John Anderson.
Oh, yeah, that's one of my favorite songs ever, Seminole Wind.
But you can't play that. You can't play that at a basketball game.
Songs about how corporate capitalism is destroying the swamps.
Right. Yeah.
That song's really kind of radical if you think about it. For country radio in 1991, man, I love that song.
It's a good song.
John Anderson is perhaps the most underrated country singer of all time. He is.
He was my favorite when I was a kid.
Yeah. He is. He's outstanding. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, no. I don't want to derail. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, I like John Anderson quite a bit. I don't know if I'd say that's even my favorite.
Right? Swingin's a terrible song.
Yes.
Oh, I don't know. Swangin'. It's terrible, but it's fun, right?
For our listeners who don't know, he's not talking about wife swapping. He's talking about sitting on the front porch.
Chocolate pie. Mama was in the kitchen cutting chicken up to fry. Daddy was in the backyard rolling up a garden hose. I was on the porch with Charlotte feeling up down to my toes, and we were swinging.
Swinging.
Yes, we were swinging.
Swinging.
Little Charlotte, she's a
just a swinging.
With his lady love.
Little Charlotte.
Is that her name?
Little Charlotte. She's as pretty as the angels when they sing. But speaking of, you talked about Native Americans liking that song. It's actually also was surprising to me that Amish people really loved Weird Al Yankovic's Amish Paradise.
How did they hear it?
Well, I have a buddy whose family owned a pallet shop in an Amish country, and a lot of Amish folks worked there. And he said that they always had that thing on the radio. Like, they played it over and over. They loved that song. And so, yeah. So I hear it secondhand that the Amish love that. So
that's,
I guess,
amazing.
With that, we should move into our other offensive stuff for today. So we're talking today, instead of talking about a stretch of time as we've been doing in the past few episodes, we're going to sort of pause that and talk about three figures in country music, or at least affiliated with country music. One of these guys is a country singer who sort of dips his toe into other genres. One of them is a non-country singer who dips his toe into country. And then one of them is clearly a country singer, and I don't think we'll ever be confused with anything else other than maybe in his lifestyle. So these are Johnny Cash, George Jones, and Elvis.
In that order.
Not in that order, yeah. Sorry. Johnny Cash being the country singer who toys with other genres, right? He's clearly interested in other genres. Elvis would be the non-country singer, but he does country stuff and certainly has a country background. I mean, both where he grew up and where he recorded. And then George Jones is the guy who you would never think that he is anything other than country.
One of the few guys from that generation who never even tried to cross over. He didn't even seem interested in it.
Mm-mm.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'll be interested. I'm kind of curious as to why that might be, and I'll be interested to see if you guys have thoughts on that. Johnny Cash, he had a career that spanned, what, 5 decades? From the mid-1950s into the early 2000s. And again, he did a little bit of everything. He basically had a solid recording output each of those decades except for the 1980s.
Yeah.
Kind of his weak era was in the 80s. And some of that was had something to do with the production label that he'd been working with, the record label he'd been working with. He got in a fight with, I think it was Columbia.
Mercury. He left Columbia for Mercury.
Right. Well, and then he ended up at CBS, and I don't know what, if they were just called CBS or if that was the name of their, if they had some other name on their recording label. But he in the early 80s decided he was tired of working. I think it was with CBS. So he on his way out, recorded a song called The Chicken in Black.
For 2 long years, my head hurt bad, so the doctor checked me and he shook his head. He said, I'm sorry to tell you, but your body's outlived your brain. He said, I know this doctor in New York, son, and he'll fix you right up with a brand new one. So the head doctor met me when I stepped down off of the train. He said, we had this bank robber killed last night. His body shot, but his brain's all right. I'll give you a transplant, boy, and you'll be okay. I got my new brain in and I was feeling great. I went right back to Nashville with no headache, but something strange happened when I walked in the bank one day. I said, stick 'em up, everybody, I'm robbing this place. Drop all of your money in my guitar case. Don't nobody move and don't nobody reach for that door. A lady said, why, you're Johnny Cash. I said, no, ma'am, I'm the Manhattan Flash, and I am the best bank robber in New York.
Which if he were listing the worst country songs, Chicken in Black would make that list. And if you go and listen to it, I think it's kind of fun, but it's obviously a gimmick song with not a lot going for it, other than if you know who Johnny Cash is.
He did, it must be said, a lot of gimmick songs. A lot of gimmick songs.
Yeah.
He did. And I think that's one thing that I want to talk about. His attitude was very much, I'm going to record what I want to record, and if no one wants to listen to it, that's too bad. And a lot of his stuff nobody wanted to listen to. but there was just enough of his stuff that he sort of kept his name out there. After his slump in the 80s, where I think the main recordings he put out were the Highwaymen recordings, which of course were not solo acts. It was him and Willie Nelson and Chris Christopherson, and is it Waylon Jennings is the other one?
Waylon Jennings.
I can never remember if it's Waylon Jennings or Merle Haggard, but it's Waylon Jennings. And then in the 90s, there was sort of a Johnny Cash renaissance, right? Especially when he started doing crossover music, performing with Soundgarden and Nine Inch Nails, and doing music that is in no way, shape, or form country, but doing it very well.
To correct you, he didn't perform with them. He just covered their songs.
Yeah, sorry. He covered their songs. There are a couple of the groups he did perform with, but I don't think it was either of them.
Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers were his backing band for the second of those American recordings.
Right, and he did also record with Dave Matthews.
Mm. Ugh.
Yeah, and it wasn't good. But again,
well,
he wanted to
does is right.
Well, and he also would record in like L.A. clubs. Like some of those live recordings from that time are in like punk rooms, basically, right? And so he was definitely crossing over at that moment with those albums.
All of that stuff is due to Rick Rubin, who. Yeah. Maybe best known for that now, but at the time I think was best known for being the Beastie Boys DJ of all things. and I just heard an interview with him on one of Malcolm Gladwell's podcasts where he talks about how he wanted to like bring an artist back from the dead, and somebody suggested Johnny Cash, to whom he'd never really listened. And he picks all the songs and comes up with what these things are going to sound like. And he encourages Cash essentially to sing not as a human being, Johnny Cash, but as the legend of Johnny Cash, which is what those American recordings albums really are, if you think about it.
Right. Yeah, getting ready for this, I've gone back and listened to you. So I read Cash's second autobiography, not realizing it was the second one when I started it. It's just called Cash. So he's got
Johnny Cash's autobiography, Cash by Johnny Cash.
Yeah, pretty much. he has an earlier one that's called Man in Black. That's apparently all of the drug usage and the early stages of his career. I didn't realize that when I picked up the second one, but the second one is more his. I don't even know how to describe this. It's sort of one third kind of theological, philosophical musings, one third fun stories about people that I know, and then one third. Giant lists of names of people that I've encountered in my life. So two thirds of that book are kind of interesting, and one third of that book really is just a big list of names. But in that, he talks about the music that he thought was the most important. So I tried to listen to that, and it's his gospel recordings. It's the Christian music he wrote, and it's the concept albums. So he's got a spoken word album in defense of Native American rights.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say, we're talking about Native American country music.
Yeah, and so the Ballad of Ira Hayes, right, is probably his most famous song. Well, if it's even a song off of that. I forget if that one's spoken word or if it's sung.
Ira Hayes, Ira Hayes, call him drunken Ira Hayes, he won't answer anymore. Not the whiskey-drinking Indian nor the Marine that went to war. Gather round me, people, there's a story I would tell about a brave young Indian you should remember well. From the land of the Pima Indian, a proud and noble band who farmed the Phoenix Valley in Arizona land. Down the ditches a thousand years, the waters grew Ira's people's crops, till the white man stole their water rights and the sparkling water stopped. Now Ira's folks were hungry, and their land grew crops of weeds. When war came, Ira volunteered and forgot the white man's creed. Call him drunken Ira Hayes, he won't answer anymore. Not the whiskey-drinking Indian nor the Marine that went to war.
I think it's sung. I remember some of the melody, so yeah.
Yeah, and honestly, that... even having listened to that in the last 3 weeks, I don't know that I could name most of the stuff that he sung on his gospel albums, other than, you know, the hymns that I already knew. Like the things he wrote, the songs that he added in, I still know Get Rhythm and One Piece at a Time and Ring of Fire. I don't know any of the concept stuff, despite having listened to it recently. So, I mean, his career is really interesting, and I think... an example of someone who is sort of famous kind of despite himself.
Hmm.
So strengths and weaknesses. I see you guys have both have notes in this. What are some of the strengths of Johnny Cash?
I think I wrote this first note, like straightforwardness and like authority. Like there's a stripped down nature to him, and it's his voice just is a natural thing. It doesn't feel like it's produced, or it doesn't feel like it's, he's straining in any way. He just sort of openly presents himself as he is. And there's like an honesty, I suppose, to his self-presentation. And like, I think I said, his voice is like a man just standing in front of you telling about his life, right? Mm-hmm. And the deepness of his voice, I think, lends it this kind of, oh, and it's like ancient wisdom almost. He has this sort of grandfatherly sort of like voice of experience that just comes naturally through the instrument, right? He doesn't seem like someone who had to caretake his voice, right? He's not someone who developed a voice or anything like that. It was basically just something that descended, like popped right out of Zeus's head, kind of.
Well, it also actually somehow gets better as it begins to rot in the last decade of his life.
Yeah, because he matches it nicely with the themes that he's singing about, right? And so that's another strength, is he sort of, when he's at his best, kind of understands himself enough to know what songs he can honestly sing, right? And it works magically.
This is, I mean, I'm not sure he does understand that. I think that's why Rick Rubin is so important to his career renaissance, because Rubin understood that. And so he's got Cash singing these songs that work with who Cash is as a, not as a person, but as a legend. Whereas if you look at the stuff Cash is choosing for himself the decade before that, it's not great, to say the least.
I'll add in a strength of Cash. So this is, I think, he shares with Elvis and does not share with Jones. I don't think he has like the best voice in country music. But I think he has the kind of voice that works okay in any genre. So when he sings rock and roll, it's good. When he sings gospel, it's good. Even if the songs aren't memorable, they're not bad performances. They're fine. When he sings, you know, Nine Inch Nails, it's good, right? It really does cross. You could not possibly imagine George Jones singing Hurt. even if thematically it works.
Yeah, it absolutely would. Like, it would work as well for him thematically as it would for Cash.
Yeah. But the voice just doesn't, I mean, it just doesn't work that way. And I think Elvis has that, where he can sing country and he can sing gospel and he can sing, you know, pick your genre of choice. He can sing it, and maybe he's not going to be the best in any of those, but he's solid enough. I should throw in my wife thinks that the strength of Johnny Cash is sort of what you were saying, Danny, where he is every man, but you know, a good singer. You know, most people are not good singers, but Johnny Cash is, he has that advantage of, he sounds like he is just the guy off the street.
Yeah.
Again, both in what he is singing and in the way he's singing it.
But he also has with that a kind of moral authority. So he's an everyman, right. But also you trust him. Danny was getting at that with the grandfatherly wisdom. But
right. Yeah. Sort of Reagan-esque.
In the 90s, he's good. And like that's how he presents himself. He's a good man.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, if you know anything about his pre-conversion days is funny to think about, but
right,
yeah,
because he was not a good man.
But he even uses that wildness to his moral advantage. I mean, it's really hard to imagine many other singers doing entire concerts in prisons in front of like hostile audiences like that. You know what I mean? Or unpredictable audiences at least. Right. And so yeah, but he's somehow able to pull that off because there's a bravery, I guess, to him, right? And so yeah.
And a principle, I don't know if it's a true story, but in the biopic Walk the Line, the record company says, you know, your Christian fans aren't going to like you doing concerts in prison. And he says, well, then they're not Christians, which is, I mean, really a remarkable thing to say. And I hope it's true.
Sure.
You know, my favorite Johnny Cash story is about his wild years. Bono tells this story. U2 was having dinner with him at his house in the 90s, and before dinner Cash prays, right, and he thanks God for getting him off drugs and all this other stuff, and then the prayer is over, and as soon as he says amen, he looks over at Bono and says, sure do miss the drugs though.
Well, speaking of drugs, we should talk just briefly about some of Johnny Cash's weaknesses, and Michael, I think you had thoughts on this.
Yeah, I don't like Johnny Cash as much as everybody else does. And I've been trying to figure out the reason, and I think it's he does not have good phrasing. To me, the best phraser in all of country music is 1970s Willie Nelson. Willie Nelson can't sing anymore, but in the 70s, there were very few singers more sensitive and better at phrasing. That is, where you put the pauses, where you hold things out, than Willie Nelson was. Cash has none of that. Cash, what I've written down here, I don't remember writing it, but it sounds pretty good to me. George Jones is like a waterfall, and Elvis is like a hot air balloon, and Johnny Cash is the face of a mountain. He doesn't even bother trying to phrase, and I think that's what bothers me about the way he sings compared to these other guys. One genre you cannot imagine him doing is jazz, and I think the reason for that is jazz is about 80% about phrasing, which is why Willie Nelson is so good at it. Mm-hmm. Cash just can't do that, and so a lot of his music sounds very clunky to me because of it.
No, that's fair, and I think that's maybe one of the reason that he does. Well, I guess I don't know if this is why he does the spoken word albums, but you can see where his spoken word albums and his regular albums are going to be able to sit side by side pretty comfortably because they're the same.
Yeah, it's kind of funny that he was ever in a band with Willie Nelson. And then he did concerts with them because, like, Nelson as a singer and as a guitar player just blows Cash out of the water. And yet Cash is the one that non-country fans like.
Well, and that maybe Nelson does better songs. Like, at least the songs that come to mind when I think of Willie Nelson are songs that anyone who sings those are going to have the same phrasing just because of how they're written.
Ooh, I don't know about that. Listen, so Willie did an album called Songbird in 2006, which is actually, you know, Willie Nelson puts out 10 albums a year, and most of them aren't great. Ryan Adams produced that record, And he does the song Songbird by Fleetwood Mac, which is a great song when Fleetwood Mac sings it, and even better when Willie Nelson sings it. And the phrasing's totally different. Or he does $1,000 Wedding, which is a great Graham Parsons.
Oh, sure.
And he...
I'm thinking that's... I don't think those are when I think Willie Nelson, though, right? You think Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain, you think Crazy, you think...
But he doesn't sing... His phrasing on Crazy isn't the same as Patsy Cline's.
Sorry, I'm just thinking. I'm trying to think of both versions at the same time, and it's not working. I will take your word for it. I haven't listened to him recently, and you know this stuff much better than I do. So, I will admit that I am wrong on this one.
1970s Willie Nelson to me is almost a jazz singer. He's very close, and sometimes sure. He just does jazz music, like Stardust, the album Stardust.
Yep.
But anyway, I'm sure we'll do another episode on Willie Nelson, so I don't want to.
Yeah, he's coming up on the next one, I'm sure.
I don't want to overstate here.
Yeah. But I
think comparing Johnny Cash to him or to George Jones, country music's other great phraser, is enlightening, because I really think that's his big weakness. That's what I don't like about him. He's also very rarely on key, but that's not as big of a problem to me in country music as the phrasing is.
Hmm.
Well, and increasingly, no one knows about that anyway, as our musical literacy declines.
Right, right. Listen, he's always about a quarter note flat.
Yeah,
sure.
I think I agree with that, actually, that whole assertion about his phrasings. There's a particular song on the first it's just called American Recordings, the first of those albums, that I love that album. That's still one of my favorite records ever that I listen to all the time. And most of it's covers. And one of, there's a Tom Waits cover he does called Down There by the Train.
There's a place I know where the train goes slow, where the sinner can be washed in the blood of the Lamb. There's a river by the trestle, down by Sinner's Grove, down where the willow and the dogwood grow. You can hear the whistle, you can hear the bell, from the halls of heaven to the gates of hell. And there's room for the forsaken if you're there on time. You'll be washed of all your sins and all of your crimes if you're down there by the train. Down there by the train, down there by the train, down there by the train, down there where the train goes slow.
And I always loved Johnny Cash's version of it, and then, because I'd never heard Tom Waits sing it, and then Tom Waits actually released a version of it on his Orphans collection, which is like this 3-volume thing that he did, and I heard Waits sing that same song, and I'm like, oh.
Lord.
that this is so much better than Johnny Cash's version of the song. And it's the phrasing. Clearly Waits has a voice that's limited, right? But it's the way he sings the song, and says the words, kind of. And that's a distinct difference. And that's definitely a song that I always loved when Johnny Cash sang it, but I realized what was missing from it when I heard Waits himself sing it.
But I mean, again, Waits is a jazz guy. Waits is basically a really bad jazz singer. I mean, really bad in the sense that, as you say, he has no range whatsoever. The other one I think is illuminating is his cover of One by U2. It's a pretty good cover, but Bono sings it better, and Bono doesn't sing that much better than anybody. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't think Bono's a great singer either, but the U2 version of One is much better to me than the Johnny Cash version. The one on that album, that's American 3, that I think he really improves is The Mercy Seat.
It all began when they took me from my home and put me on death row. A crime for which I'm totally innocent, you know. I began to warm and chill to objects and their fields, a ragged cup, a twisted mop, the face of Jesus in my soup, those sinister dinner deals, the meal trolley's wicked wheels, a hook bone rising from my food, and all things either good or ungood. And the mercy seat is waiting, and I think my head is burning, and in a way I'm yearning to be done with all this weighing of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And anyway, I told the truth, and I'm not afraid to die. I hear stories from the chamber. Christ was born into a manger, and like some ragged stranger, he died upon the cross. Might I say it seems so fitting, in its way he was a carpenter by trade, or at least that's what I'm told.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The Nick Cave song, The Mercy Seat, he that song is his now, as far as I'm concerned.
One more weakness. I know that you're going to get into politics a little bit, and this might be related. This might be a way to transition into that. I do feel like there's a hubris to Johnny Cash that sometimes bit him, right? And and a good example of that is the Folsom Prison album. He did a song by a guy named Glenn Shirley, the Greystone Chapel, I think is what it was, who was a prisoner at Folsom Prison, and he wrote a song about the chapel in the prison, and Johnny Cash got up and sang it as part of that album. And then he advocated for this guy, and he ended up getting him released from prison, and he had some sort of very brief minor country music career, and went on to live a disastrous life, kind of, right? And so that was sort of like, I felt like Johnny Cash's social justice instinct got the best of him sometimes. And I think that's a real, like, human example of maybe he should have spent more time in jail. You know what I'm saying? Glenn Shirley. And so, yeah, I feel like that's a kind of a poignant example where he's doing good, right, in his mind, but in a prideful sort of way. And I think that that's a refrain that comes up every now and then with Johnny Cash and politically, his political activism, at least. So
his politics are very interesting, right? Because in a lot of ways, he's very conservative.
Yeah.
But he has that, as you say, social justice instinct. His politics may be more interesting than any classic country singer other than Merle Haggard, whose politics are bewildering.
His politics are very fluid, to say the least. I think that entire section is going to be hard to edit because I'm going to be continually tempted to splice in lines from Archer with people saying phrasing.
Phrasing?
So Johnny Cash on politics, and this again is from his autobiography, his second autobiography. He says, country life as I knew it, that country life as I knew it, might really be a thing of the past. And when music people today talk about being country, they don't mean they know or even care about the land and the life it sustains and regulates. They're talking more about choices, a way to look, a group to belong to, a kind of music to call their own. Which begs a question, is there anything behind the symbols of modern country? Or are the symbols themselves the whole story? Are the hats, the boots, the pickup trucks, and the honky-tonking poses all that's left of a disintegrating culture? Back in Arkansas, a way of life produced a certain kind of music. Does a certain kind of music now produce a way of life? Maybe that's okay, I don't know. Perhaps I'm just alienated, feeling the cold wind of exclusion blowing my way. The country music establishment, including country music radio and the Country Music Association, does, after all, seem to have decided that whatever country is, some of us aren't. I wonder how many of those people ever filled a cotton sack.
The guy was really a deep thinker, whatever mm-hmm. else you want to say about him.
Yeah, he had a degree in Bible studies.
I know he read just constantly because he went blind toward the end of his life, and it was really terrible for him because he read so much.
Yeah, he did, of course, going to a sit-down seminary was probably never a realistic option for him, certainly once he was famous. But he and his wife both did like an online theology degree, like the whole program. And he put it to work in ways that I think are really kind of interesting. There's a lot that could be drawn out of that, even just that one quote, right? The disappearing tradition, the sort of deep-rooted conservatism that's not reflexive God and country stuff, but much more rooted, like almost a Wendell Berry type, being built on the land. Certainly the idea of suffering, right, and a very specific kind of suffering, not the I'm suffering because my latte was a little bit cold, and because my latest player, whatever the stereotype is, has been rejected, but suffering because I actually had to get up and do grueling manual labor all day for most of my life. And I think it's interesting, and I don't know, I'm still kind of going over whether or not I think that's an accurate description of why country music has changed, because this earlier generation actually did grow up very poor and mostly on the farm, whereas the later generation didn't. And I'd be interested to hear you guys' thoughts on that. This to me was kind of useful. I didn't really start to appreciate country music until more recently, and in part I think it's because of the difference between the South and the West. That when we get to the next sort of chronological episode, I'll have more to say about that. But the Johnny Cash, I grew up hauling cotton and watching trains. That wasn't really my experience. We don't have cotton, and the manual labor that we did was a very different kind. Anyway, that's my own reflection. Now, what do you guys think? Is Cash onto something here? Of the three of us, am I the only one who can truly appreciate country music because I grew up doing manual labor on a farm? Are you guys just posers?
I grew up in the suburbs. My father grew up packing cotton sacks, so I mean,
dad and I can listen to
that's
this.
That's right. And by the way, if anybody wants to hear my dad talk about country music, he did a very early episode of Sectarian Review about Merle Haggard.
Yes, it was awesome.
Oh, that's right.
That was a lot of fun. I had both Michael Farmers at the same time. So,
what's interesting to me about this is the way he talks about modern country music as a consumer choice, as opposed to something that arises naturally from lifestyle. I think there's something to that, right? And it's not just about the commercialization of country music. It's about country music becoming a lifestyle rather than a lifestyle, I suppose. I need to think that out more because clearly I haven't thought about what words I want to use. But
yeah.
I agree there's a change there.
Yeah, and it kind of maps on some level on political divides, right? Which are, our kind of current Democrat-Republican. A lot of that is branding, right? And so I think a lot of the branding of this commercial country music is it maps on to people in places, regardless of geography, right? And so there are people in Pennsylvania where I live who are really into country music and the kind of the aesthetics of this kind of pop country music. If they would not stomach a Johnny Cash song or a George Jones song, probably more so, because it's more tied to something beyond a consumeristic sort of identity, right? And so I think that, yeah, the music choices, I mean, I listen every once in a while. I'm in a store, they'll be playing some modern country music song, and it's, you know, short shorts, belt buckles, pickup truck. It's all like the same song with the same beat, very kind of like pop music, hip hop influenced, right? I think I said on an earlier episode.
Have you seen the video on YouTube where they create the ultimate bro country song by splicing lines, and you cannot tell?
There's not a difference between any of them, right? Yeah, I think I said on an earlier episode there was Steve Earle had said that modern country music is hip hop for people who don't like black people, right? And so I think, I think that's kind of, I mean, yeah, I think definitely Johnny Cash is onto something. I think here.
You know, what strikes me about that bro country is how non-specific it is as opposed to Cash's music, which is really hyper-specific. It's not just here's a prison. It's here's Folsom Prison. And yeah. Here's the things I imagine them to be doing on the train as they go by. And I think we talked about this in the very first episode, that specificity is really the key to a good country song.
Right.
Yeah.
And even somebody like Garth Brooks is pretty specific. And I understand that the people he's talking about here are not the bro country people, right? The people he's talking about here are the Garth Brookses of the world. Mm. But, I mean, looking back, Garth Brooks has songs that are really brimming with actual detail as opposed to these cliches about fireflies and cutoff shorts.
Yeah, we'll get to Brooks. I think he is more the end of this Cash and Jones style tradition, and kind of the beginning of the bro. He's a transitional figure, but I think if you have to put him somewhere.
Clear, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like if he's got to go somewhere, he goes with Jones and Cash more than he goes with, I would even struggle to name a modern one.
There's an artistry to Garth Brooks that is not existent in what came after him. I definitely say that. Yeah.
And he's got good songwriters too. I mean, that's a lot of it, you know, country music. A lot of times people are not writing their own songs. And so it's about picking songs as much as it's about being talented. I mean, somebody like Alan Jackson writes a lot of his own music, and Alan Jackson certainly belongs to the tradition we're talking about rather than the country tradition.
Yeah. Yeah, I think about what you're saying about specificity. When a modern country song talks about small towns, it's not about a specific small town. That's like that's a political identifier, right? That is a generic thing that is shorthand for a matrix of political beliefs. And so I there is something that's just really consumeristic and crass and weirdly postmodern about that kind of country music, I think.
Right. I mean, Johnny Cash, obviously, not only can talk about a small town, but he can tell you, you know, what's the name of the feed store and what do they sell and what can you do there other than just buy feed and who's going to be there at any given moment. And the modern country songs, at least the chunk I've heard, the feed store is some kind of Starbucks. You know, I mean, it's who knows what's going on.
Yeah.
It's just generic small town.
Yeah.
I was reading about Florida Georgia Line, who I think is probably the biggest act in contemporary country music. And I read that what they wanted was to sound like Nickelback.
Success. Congratulations,
boys. Congratulations. It's weird. Well, it was really disorienting because I've never heard anybody say anything good about Nickelback. They sell millions of records. So somebody's out there listening to them. Probably the same people who are listening to Florida Georgia Line.
Someone who does not sound like Nickelback, we should move on to George Jones. Unless you want to say he does sound like Nickelback, Danny, why don't you walk us through George Jones?
Well, yeah, I mean, so George Jones is, without a doubt, I mean, one of the probably two greatest countries. I mean, it's either him or Merle Haggard, right? I mean, this
or
is
Ray
sort
Price.
Of... Yeah, I suppose, yeah. But, I mean, I would throw Willie Nelson in there too, but yeah, but it's
sure.
Typically the conversation swirls around George Jones, right? And so, primarily we're going to be talking a lot about his voice and his singing, right? Not just the instrument, but the way he actually embodies a song. I did have my mom told me once. I have a sort of personal George Jones story. Back in when his kind of, you know, 60s days, he was touring and in West Virginia, where my mom was living, she went to see the show and he was like talking between songs forever. And so she had to go to the restroom, she told me. And so this is before I was born. And so she said, well, I'm just going to get up and go. And then, she gets up and leaves and he like stops his monologue and makes a joke about my mom because he knew she was going to the restroom. He says, just follow your nose, young lady.
Now, was he on cocaine at this time? Or
it sounds like it, right? And so my mom was kind of appalled that George Jones like shamed her in front of an auditorium. But yeah, I love that story because I also love George Jones. And so, but yeah, for me, I mean, it's the gifts of his gifts as a singer, right? In a way that he just sort of can. It's almost like a method actor embodying a role, right? He just embodies a song in an almost mystical way. Michael, you look like you want to say something about this.
Is really an amazing singer. My experience with him was relatively limited until I found out we were doing this episode about him. And so I went and bought a 2-disc set of his singles, and my God, is he good. Like, yeah. I knew he was good, but it's really indescribable how good he is.
Yeah, and there's a depth. I mean, you could listen to those recordings and just pick. It's like looking at a Monet painting or something and finding new little details all the time. There's such color and such artistry in the voice, right? And
or so, looking at a good painting.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I see what you're saying. But ironically, I mean, not ironically, unexpectedly, he's very much influenced by Hank Williams, and his early music is very honky tonk, right? It doesn't sound at all like He Stopped Loving Her Today. That's a much later sort of development for George Jones's career. He's beginning in the 50s. He wears the cowboy hat and he sings songs that sound a lot like Hank Williams. And so he's got this kind of link to me between that traditional form of country music that we talked before about how most people think this is actual country music. When they're thinking of that, they think of someone like Hank Williams. So he is kind of a link between that and this richly produced, quote unquote, Nashville sound, countrypolitan sound that develops in the 70s. And so for me, kind of his genius is the way that he actually, because of his like authentic, like pure country voice, he's able to sort of legitimize that Nashville sound finally, right? It no longer becomes like the commercial alternative to actual country music that's in Bakersfield or wherever. It's actually country music. And I think to a large degree, because of folks like Tammy Wynette and George Jones, because they were able to kind of emerge out of this rootsy forms of country music and, just plant that inside this production value of the Nashville sound. And so I think that that's really kind of his great innovation for country music. I mean, and not always to the best, right? Because there's a lot of crap that comes with that. But yeah.
How hard do you think he worked at it? Because when you hear it, it sounds like he tossed it off. It sounds like he's just some idiot savant who knew exactly how to sing the song. And I wonder how much he thought about it.
Like in terms of like rehearsal and how much sort of thought he went into like the recording sessions and stuff.
So, I mean, George Jones's signature is he holds these lines a little too long. Right. Mm. And that's what makes him so distinctive as a singer. And again, it's back to phrasing.
Phrasing.
And I wonder if that's something he did instinctually or whether he said, you know, that would sound good if I held that half a second longer.
Possibly so, right? But it's always linked for a purpose, right? It isn't to show what he can do with his voice. It's to demonstrate something that character in the song is feeling or going through, right? It's a way to reflect some sort of thematic thing. And so, I mean, whether he just has amazing instincts or he actually sort of scripts things out like an actor, I don't know. It's a really interesting question.
It's hard to imagine 1970s George Jones, which is George Jones at his best, right? It's hard to imagine him working anything out. You just imagine him like showing up, lying down on the floor and singing it.
when he showed up.
Right. No show Jones.
That was his reputation, right? And yet, I mean, it didn't destroy his career in a small town like Nashville, which it did a lot of other people, those sorts of reputations. George Jones was able to kind of almost make it work for him, right? It created a legend around him a little bit that works with his music very well.
Along with the divorce, right? His relationship with Tammy Wynette gets played out in songs written by other people.
Yeah.
It's really kind of amazing. Like it's like they had this whole team of songwriters scripting their life like a soap opera.
Yeah. Yeah. And so both of them came, their careers were assisted by a producer named Billy Sherrill, and who's like sort of one of the great architects of that Nashville sound, cosmopolitan or countrypolitan sound, which when we say it, a lot of string orchestrations, it's very kind of importing a lot of elements of pop music into country music, right?
Overwrought, it must be said, but
yes.
Like overwrought in a good way when it's good. I mean, George Jones's material, He Stopped Loving Her Today, is a super overwrought song, but you wouldn't want to hear it if it wasn't.
Right.
The production of that song doesn't make it because it's a great song, but it pushes it over the edge.
Yeah. Yeah, it is definitely a point when the kitsch kind of is working, right? Sometimes it doesn't. Some of those songs, there's a really terrible song that he and Tammy do called The Ceremony, I think. It's this weird sort of spoken word vowels exchange marriage ceremony thing.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered together in the presence of God and these witnesses to join this man and this woman in the bonds of holy matrimony. Do you, Tammy, take this man, George, to be your lawfully wedded husband, to love and to cherish until death do you part?
I'll take this man, and by him I'll stand. I promise that we'll never part. To him I'll be true. There'll be no one new. From him till death do us part.
And it's painful to listen to. It's so cheesy, right? There's a... For as great as Jones and Ouellette were together and individually, there is a lot of dreck that goes along with those that we gratefully don't remember.
Well, yeah. I mean, both of them are quintessential singles artists, right? I mean, they're not making albums where you're going to want to listen to the whole album.
Yeah, with a couple of, there's like one exception for me is the Grand Tour, which I sort of want to talk about at the end, but. So there's like a mythology even around their divorce, though, right? So the drinking is part of Jones's mythology, right? Their mercurial relationship, which was fiery, there's, I mean, accusations from her about abuse and violence.
Supposedly fired a shotgun at her.
Yeah. There's right. Real violence there, and yet there's a bond. Even in 1980, I think they made an album together, like after being divorced for 10 years. Was it called The One or something like that? So those two are linked largely through the production of Billy Sherrill, right? So he started with her and then kind of loaned on to George Jones, and in a sense created both of them, the personas of both of them. But their relationship is super interesting. They do a number of duet albums together. And so that becomes a motif in country music later on that gets other, that, you know, Kenny Rogers and Dolly Parton do this.
Conway Twitty and Loretta Lynn.
Yes. Yeah. Which is, you know, she's, you know, marrying down in that relationship, I would say.
Ouch.
Conway Twitty's the worst. I hate Conway Twitty.
Really? Have you ever heard the joke about Conway Twitty?
Maybe what?
So there's a new preacher in town, and everybody says he looks just like Conway Twitty. So he's going to go around and meet all his parishioners. So he knocks on the first door. Woman answers and goes, "Oh, Conway Twitty." And he says, "No, ma'am, I'm not Conway Twitty. I just look like him." So he talks with her a while and goes to the next house. And the woman says, "Oh, Conway Twitty." And he says, "No, ma'am, I'm not Conway Twitty. I just look like him." Goes to another house and he knocks on the door and a woman answers holding up a towel. She's just gotten out of the bathroom and she throws her hands up in the air and says, "Oh, Conway Twitty." And he says, "Hello, darling."
That's amazing. I have heard that. And that's very Conway Twitty. I don't know. Sorry. I guess we won't devote a show to him, I think. Thank God. But this
a full show on Louisiana Woman, Mississippi Man, one of the kitschiest songs ever recorded.
Yes, I know.
That's almost as bad as Jackson, in my opinion.
See, Jackson I still like. I don't know how, maybe I'm too generous to it or something, but I still do like that fiery relationship that's in that song. But back to, you know, George and Tammy here. So they actually marketed the divorce, right? I mean, the record company like made money off the divorce. It's not a great album, but it's an amazing album cover. The Battle, which is his first album after the divorce, which is just like this stark photograph of like an empty bed and their shoes laying at the foot of the bed. It's just an amazing album cover. The album's okay.
That song is brutal.
Dawn breaks on the battlefield, while the morning mist lays heavy on the ground. And the silence is like thunder as the enemy prepares another round. In her soft satin armor, lying on the far side of the bed, wounded and heartbroken, scarred by the killing words I said. I have no rules in battle, so I fire the guns of anger once again. Oh, she's such a little thing, and there's no doubt about it, I can win. But with teardrops as her weapon, she easily destroys my battle plan. And in shamefully retreating, I smile at her and then she takes command. Oh, what a sweet surrender. I'm captured by two lips so warm and tender. She completely surrounds me with her loving arms again. It was love that brought the battle to an end. Now the enemies are lovers once again.
Yeah, it is, right? It is, but it's sort of a concept album about the divorce, right? And so, and it becomes this big selling hit. And so that's one thing about this relationship that's so interesting, is that it actually, the life becomes the art, right? And the art becomes the product that people then replicate. And so it's a really kind of tragic and yet important part of understanding George Jones's music. Now, later on in his career, to me, he had a kind of a sad decline artistically. I mean, talk about going into kind of cornball territory, right? I mean, his sort of late music is really sort of, I don't know, dopey, I think.
With one exception. He has a single from 1999 called Choices. I believe it's his last hit single. That song, it's, you know, written for him, I'm sure. But it's all about him getting over his drug addiction and all this stuff. And, I mean, that is a remarkable vocal performance on a song that could have been really maudlin and isn't because of the way he sings it.
Yeah.
I've had choices since the day that I was born. There were voices that told me right from wrong. If I had listened, no, I wouldn't be here today, living and dying with the choices I've made. I was tempted by an early age. I found I liked drinking. Oh, and I never turned it down. There were loved ones, but I turned them all away. Now I'm living and dying with the choices I've made.
Choices is a fantastic song. I actually like some of his later gospel stuff, too.
I guess I'm only speaking to stuff that was like radio fodder, right?
Yeah, and so, no, that's fair.
And I'm unaware of the gospel stuff.
You don't, I don't need no rocking chair?
Yeah, that sort of thing, right? There's a few like cutesy songs, right, that are okay, but they're very, I don't know, just shticky, I guess, I don't know how to say it. And so, he seemed so desperate for money at the end. I remember I was somewhere, I don't know where I was, in Southern Ohio, Portsmouth, Ohio, in some like podunk little dollar store, like, and there's like George Jones dog food on there. It's like he would just sell his name to anything. It was pathetic, right? And so,
although to be fair, you know he ate some dog food in 1977.
I'm sure
right?
he did. I'm sure he did. But
that's a man who knows his dog food.
But I guess the song that I love the most is the Grand Tour.
Step right up, come on in. If you'd like to take the grand tour of a lonely house that once was home, sweet home, I have nothing here to sell you, just some things that I will tell you, some things I know will chill you to the bone. Over there sits the chair where she'd bring the paper to me and sit down on my knee and whisper, oh, I love you. Now she's gone forever, and this old house will never be the same without the love that we once knew. Straight ahead, that's the bed.
I think that is like an unbelievably devastating song that's based on real life relationships, right? And I think it comes out after the divorce as well. And so it is like one of those songs in which his singing ability, his sort of character development, and the material of the song come together in just like this perfect way. And I don't know how many thousands of times I've heard that song, and it still brings me to tears when I listen to it. As you leave, you'll see nursery, right? That line right there is just like utterly devastating. And so, I mean, you talk about someone who is like, when he is on, the country music is perfected, right? I mean, there's just never been a better country singer than George Jones when he is on. And I just think that he's sort of like country music's maybe ultimate gift to American culture in a lot of ways. Him and Merle Haggard together, I think, for sure. But by himself, he was just like unbelievably great when he was in his prime.
But I don't think that he is someone whom non-country fans really listen to. I mean, Merle Haggard has a following outside. Merle Haggard played Bonnaroo the last couple years of his life, you know. But George Jones doesn't have that kind of credibility, I think, because the songs are kind of corny. And it's his performance that makes them not corny.
Well, and he also mostly, other than the Tammy Wynette era, like he mostly flew solo, right? I mean, he didn't have a Highwayman album. He didn't have
an album with Willie Nelson called Yesterday's Wine in the mid '80s. It's not very good.
Well, right, and he, I mean, Johnny Cash, you could see him on stage with anyone, right?
Yeah.
Willie Nelson.
Yeah, he performs with literally everyone who's ever sung a song anywhere. I think I did an album with Willie Nelson.
That was awesome,
but you
by
didn't
the way.
Do one with George Jones.
Yeah, yeah. Right?
I also think in addition to that, we're talking about these people who are distinctly outside of the Nashville establishment, right? Merle Haggard, right. Johnny Cash, all of those sort of outlaw country figures. Willie Nelson is one of these other guys who also has like a following outside of country music. There's a rebelliousness to them that is like.
Well, it helps that Willie Nelson smokes so much weed. I think that makes him very popular.
That's part of it, but there's also like a moment in which like. there's a way in which there's a spiritual connection to people who just like punk music. You can see something of that in Johnny Cash. You can see something of that spirit in Merle Haggard, right? George Jones is entirely a creature of Nashville, right?
Yeah.
Just in no way is not Nashville. And so
George Jones wears polo shirts and khaki pants.
Totally, right? Yeah. And he never strove to get out of that system, right? And that's probably why his late career was so uninteresting for the most part, whereas people like Merle Haggard and Johnny Cash and Willie Nelson, and I'm sure there are other people I can think of if I thought for 5 seconds, Waylon Jennings, they continued to kind of push themselves artistically in edgy ways outside of that studio system of Nashville, that producer town system. And George Jones never had the ambition to do that. And his voice doesn't translate into other genres. I mean, he is entirely of country music. It's like Pavarotti or something in opera. It's like you can't hear Pavarotti singing a death metal album, right?
Well, the closest thing would be White Lightning, which was a kind of rockabilly thing.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's a novelty song. It's not a great song.
Yeah.
Right.
So two Jones performances I would point to beyond the Grand Tour, which I agree. That's one of the greatest songs ever recorded. He does one with Tammy Wynette, I think their greatest song, called Take Me. Do you know that one?
Take me. Take me to your darkest room. Close every window and bolt every door. The very first moment I heard your voice, I'd be in darkness no more. Take me to your most barren desert, 1,000 miles from the nearest sea. The very moment I saw your smile, it would be like heaven to me.
That is an amazing vocal performance from both of them. And then also his song The Door.
The Door is amazing.
I've heard the sound of my dear old mama crying, and the sound of a train that took me off to war, and the awful sound of 1,000 bombs exploding. And I wondered if I could take it anymore. There were times when they almost drove me crazy, but I did my best, I took it like a man. But who would think in my lonely room I'd hear it? The one sound in the world my heart can't stand. To hear that sound and to know it.
When he sings something something or guns and war, the way he sings that, it like brings the heavens down upon earth. It's amazing. It's an amazing vocal performance.
Yeah.
The idea is that he's been in Vietnam, and still the worst thing he's ever heard is the sound of her closing the door on her way out. Again, a song that could very easily be corny.
And it borders on that, because you do have the production insert of a door closing,
the door,
right?
Slamming.
which in any other singer's hands would be utterly like eye-rollingly awful, right? But somehow Jones he's just got no self-awareness for what's corny, right? And sometimes that worked against him, but in cases like that, good Lord, it works. Yeah.
And one other thing about Tammy Wynette, whom I knew long before I knew George Jones, so I've loved Tammy Wynette for years. She has a really weird career in the sense that about half of her big hits are songs about her children asking her about her divorce. She has a bunch of those songs. Kids Say the Darndest Things, Bedtime Story.
D-I-V-O-R-C-E.
Can't
spell it. Yeah. There's a couple other ones too. I don't know what that is. I don't know who made the decision that was going to be her thing, but it is a thing. And I guess nobody did it besides her, but also nobody did it better than her. She has a really strange, remarkable career, to say nothing of Stand By Your Man.
I was just going to say, and even that song is about, you probably should get divorced.
But
that song is like, I would love to hear Victoria and the Christian Feminist take on that song, because it's troubling. But it's an incredible performance. I mean, talk about two singers that could both sing, right? That song, I really love. I love that song, and I love her singing it. It becomes really interesting when Lyle Lovett covers it.
Yeah,
because he's got this really great, like, winkingness. Like, yeah, I do want you to stand by me.
Lyle Lovett
because I'm the scoundrel. Yes, it's to my benefit that you stand by me, right? And so it's like, you know, he knows that about the song, and it's brilliant. But yeah.
Anytime Victoria complains about something in her day, I say, you know, sometimes it's hard to be a woman. You know, if you're looking for a reason to dislike Hillary Clinton, Hillary Clinton said in the 90s that she wasn't going to be like some Tammy Wynette standing by her man. The irony, of course, being Tammy Wynette got rid of the loser, and Clinton is the one who stood by her man. Wynette was apparently pissed at that. I wouldn't want to be on Tammy Wynette's bad side.
No.
You know, I mean, she'd cut you.
Although, Loretta Lynn, even more so, right? I mean, she has actual songs about that. Fifth City. She has beat up a lot of women in her life, yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah. If I owe you nothing else in my life, Coyle, I owe you making me listen to George Jones, because I was unaware of how good he really was.
I'll take that. I think that is a good accomplishment for this week. We should move to Elvis, but before we do that, I guess I have a question about Jones, and then I want to hear what you guys have to say about his politics. He's not lumped in with the rebels, you know, Johnny Cash and Willie Nelson and Waylon Jennings and so on. And I do kind of have to wonder, you know, how much cocaine should he have done to get lumped in with them? I mean, like, why don't we think about? I mean, he didn't show up for concerts.
It's the sound of the music. It's got to be the sound of the music. It's so Baroque, you know?
Yeah, and he didn't do, like, themed songs, right? He did story songs about personal heartbreak. He never,
right.
There's not many. I mean, The Door has a subtext of Vietnam, right? But it doesn't, it's not a political song. Johnny Cash was like on stage with Bob Dylan, right? And people like that sought that out a little bit more. George Jones was there to just make you cry, right? And so, yeah. Right.
I think in retrospect, he kind of does get lumped in with those guys. I think post 90s, we tend to think of him, or I tend to think of him as being not one of them, but close to them.
I guess I don't necessarily, I do think of him as sort of mainstream, like right in the middle of the mainstream country. Like if there is a standard, I tend to think it's Jones. And then the those guys are, you know, the Merle Haggards and the Waylon Jenningses, those guys are the counterpoint to the standard.
But I guess what I'm saying is, as country music gets glossier and glossier as the 20th century wears on, George Jones ends up being on the Cash, Nelson, Christopherson side of things, even if only slightly.
Yeah.
Isn't that just because they all sound more like each other because of where we're at?
Yeah, that's what,
yeah,
I think
that's
what
I'm
saying.
Saying.
Yeah.
In 1977, I'm certain that, I mean, he was not an outlaw.
No, he's wearing like cheesy tuxedos for award shows, right? You know, these like powder blues with giant collars. I mean, it's just like hideous. Like, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
He is just trying to get people to not look at his face. Let's be honest. He is one of the ugliest men who's ever lived.
The possum.
The possum. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because he literally looks like a possum. That's true.
He really
yeah.
does.
Yeah, but he, I mean, I would say that, I mean, a corollary, he's like the Frank Sinatra of country music. I mean, he is like the voice of an entire genre, and the one you would think of to perfectly embody a genre like that. And so, yeah.
Right, both nasal and twangy, but still solid. Right?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. And just the artistry there is just unbelievable, right? Yeah.
Well, what did he think about politics? Is there anything there worthwhile for...
I have no idea. Like, I honestly have no idea. I don't think he ever, I mean, yeah, his politics were don't arrest me for shooting at my wife, I think.
I mean, I think there's...
Cocaine should be legalized, I think, was his big position.
Yeah.
That guy did a mountain of cocaine.
I think that's, like, if you look at his whole life, both his music and the way he actually lived... I think the politics comes in, and there is a wrong way to live, and it doesn't just destroy you, it destroys everyone around you.
Mm-hmm.
Which he's singing about from the very beginning of his career.
Right, right. So it's not like he doesn't know, right? It's not like there's he is not caught by surprise by the effects of what he is doing to himself and how that's affecting other people. So... That was sort of my political takeaway, was like, look, this is a cautionary tale in both in terms of the actual lyrics and in terms of the way he's living. And yeah. He eventually got it, maybe if Choices is not just a chance to make money on his part, but like an actual reflection on, which it does seem to have been. He also goes through some form of conversion towards the end of his life. He starts gravitating in the Gaither circle. So you guys know what
all things. Imagine him and Mark Lowry palling around.
Go ahead. Well, I know that late in life, he had like a much younger wife later in his life. Yeah. But there actually seemed to be a real affection, and I think she was good for him.
One of his super corny 90s songs about her, right? The Right Left Hand.
I've cried a million tears down through the years, searching for that special one. And the vows I took before were all forevermore, but no matter how I tried, they came undone. Then the good Lord finally gave me the true love of a lady, someone who believes in me. And she lets me know each day that love is here to stay. I finally found someone who'll never leave. I put a golden band on the right left hand this time, and the right left hand put a golden band on mine.
Yes.
Yeah, finally put the ring on the right left hand.
Yeah. Cool.
Which is also a burn at Tammy Wynette, right?
I hope another. Not, because I think she had just died when that song came out, or she was about to die. I hope he wasn't quite that petty.
Yeah.
Well, we should move on to Elvis then. Shift, I guess, what, south and west? I'm not up on my Tennessee geography here.
That's right. Yeah.
So from Nashville to Memphis,
west.
Where Cash also gets his start. What's going on with Elvis, Michael?
So as you mentioned, Elvis is mostly country adjacent. I don't think he's ever really what you would call a country artist, but there's country in a lot of what he does. And he is kind of the platonic ideal of a dim-witted country boy who made it big. I don't know how dim-witted he really was, but that's the way he comes across, right? He's a man of appetites. I think about him in four eras, and what I would like to do, if it's okay with you guys, is just go through them. We'll talk about the first era, then the second, then the third, and then the fourth, rather than trying to cover them all at once. So the first one is the one most people know, which is the rock and roll, rockabilly era where he does things like Hound Dog and Jailhouse Rock. His versions of both of those songs, I think, are fantastic. Jailhouse Rock has got to be top 10 rock and roll era songs. And sure. I know it's controversial, but I like his version of Hound Dog better than Big Mama Thornton's, which I know you're not supposed to say that, but there it is.
I don't disagree.
What do you guys think of that era? I mean, is he the best rock and roll singer?
Gosh. I mean, he's definitely, it sounds the freshest to me of anybody else at that, from that. To listen to those songs now in the late 50s, him and Chuck Berry are the only ones that still sound like these guys could still make it today, sort of. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? And so I think, like, I always kind of pair them up as the kind of poles of that early era of rock and roll. And I always like Chuck Berry better in that era particularly. But I do think that he's definitely the top of that class of early rock and roll singer for sure.
I like Elvis better because I think he has more range. I think Chuck Berry kind of wrote two songs and just kept doing them over and over, and Elvis wrote almost anything.
Yeah, but Elvis never did My Ding-a-ling, which is...
Yeah, well, that's a point in his favor, right?
Exactly.
He has his own terrible music in 1972. My Ding-a-ling, good Lord.
Yeah, I mean, if I were going to sit down and listen to an album of greatest hits from any rock and roll singer in that era, it would be Elvis's.
And Elvis, his top 30 hits album is wall-to-wall great. That early stuff is almost unimpeachable, even when it's corny, like I Just Want to Be Your Teddy Bear. That's a corny song, and even then he sings it with so much conviction, just really amazing conviction. One thing that's interesting about him is he is really a bridge from 1940s traditional pop to 1950s rock and roll, and you don't see that better anywhere than on his Christmas album, which is about a third rock songs. Like, everybody knows his version of Here Comes Santa Claus, which is great. I think Merry Christmas Baby is on a different one, but so it's about a third rock songs, and then it's a third treacly Bing Crosby-esque 1940s traditional pop. It's really kind of off-putting because he alternates back and forth. And then the whole second half of that album is what he really loved, which was gospel music. He made several gospel albums, I think, and if he didn't, he sang an awful lot of gospel music, and his Christmas album is full of it, even though most of the gospel songs he sings aren't even Christmas music. He was just so excited to sing gospel music. So he really is a bridge in a way that I don't think people at the time probably appreciated, because he was such a controversial figure for it was a, you know, he was kind of the face or the hips of the generation gap. But listening back to him now, it's amazing how much he belongs to the previous generation as much as to what we think of as youth music in 1955.
Yeah, it's actually one of the reasons that I wanted to throw him in is I think he and Johnny Cash are both on some level just thwarted gospel singers.
Mm. Yeah. Like,
I think if they could have made a career out of doing that, they would have. And instead they made their other career and then did gospel when they could.
Well, and I mean, the thing is, Elvis, when he does that slow traditional pop stuff, it's really, really good. Like, he can do that, and he can do the kind of rock, the big, fast rock numbers. He's great at both of them, which there can't be that many people who are.
Right.
And he's truly devout in his faith. Like, I mean, and that comes across in those, I mean, his life doesn't reflect
that.
Yeah. Right?
In that true Southern way. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Right. But there is in spite of his appetites, right. He does believe. Right. And you can hear it in the way he sings those gospel songs.
And there's the old story, which was apparently true, best I can tell, that somebody, you know, he hated being called the king. And anytime somebody would call him the king, he'd say, well, there's only one king and his name is Jesus.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm sure he does. I'm pretty sure he doesn't wear a cape. Isn't that what Captain America says about God?
No, he says, there's only one God, ma'am, and he doesn't dress like that.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Sorry. Yeah.
So the next era I'm going to have much less to say about because it's so terrible. Hollywood Elvis. So this is when he's doing a bunch of movies that nobody except my wife enjoys. My wife, by the way, hardcore Elvis fan. But he's doing these terrible movies, Clam Bake and things like that. And so he puts,
Stay Away Joe deserved an Oscar.
You know, was he in that movie? I read
he
that
He was the
book.
Star of that movie.
I read that book in a Native American fiction class. It's a
Isn't it insane to think of him as the star of that?
Well, yeah. Anyway, so he makes a lot of terrible movies and puts out a number of mediocre soundtrack albums. There are some great songs. I believe Love Me Tender comes mm-hmm. from that era, and Are You Lonesome Tonight? And so there are some good singles from that era, but in general, I think it's pretty much considered the worst era of Elvis, even worse than the Vegas era at the end of his career.
Sure.
Supposedly, if you ask the Beatles who their favorite singer was, they'd say pre-Hollywood Elvis. Do you want to make a case for Clam Bake, Coyle?
I haven't seen that one.
Clam Bake with an exclamation point?
I don't. I agree with you. Most of those movies are just, at least the ones I've seen, are all terrible. I struggle to think of one that I'd be like, yeah, that was an all right movie.
To be fair, he didn't want to make them. I mean, he was not interested in doing it. They just, his manager kind of pushed him into it. He just wanted to make gospel music, I guess.
But not gospel movies. At least Johnny Cash made a gospel movie.
What movie was that?
Gospel Road.
I don't know that one. Is he a good actor? No.
No, he's really not.
I saw the remake of Stagecoach starring Willie Nelson.
Oh, okay. Was he a good actor?
No. That movie didn't need to be remade, and if it did, they sure shouldn't have put Willie Nelson as the lead. Anyway, Hollywood Elvis is not good, with a few exceptions. There are some good songs that come from that era, but most of them lack much muscle behind them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's a different kind of machine that yeah. I mean, he's being consumed by, right? And so, yeah, and so it's a purely commercial effort, and that's what they look like, right? So, yeah.
So I think the best era of Elvis is his late 60s comeback. It is corny, it is overwrought, but it's really perfect for the sort of music he's doing, and especially for the production he's doing. It blends country and soul in such a way as to make them indistinguishable. So the big album from this era is From Elvis in Memphis, one of the greatest albums of all time. You listen to it, though, and it's not clear whether you're listening to like a George Jones album or whether you're listening to a Dusty Springfield album. Mm-hmm. It's both country pop and blue-eyed soul, and that is really a fantastic album. And I like to think of that album in some ways is the first time he ever had to try to do anything. He had lost his relevance to the British invasion and psychedelic rock and stuff like that. And he comes back and just blows it out of the water. Do you guys know that album? Have you heard it?
I have not. No.
The single is In the Ghetto.
Okay.
Which I think is a really good song, but it's probably the weakest song on the album. The best one I think is a song called Only the Strong Survive. Do you know that one?
Hmm.
You've really got to go listen to From Elvis in Memphis if you haven't heard it. It's really just maybe the only good album he ever made, and one of the great albums of the late 60s.
So this is another reason I wanted to include Elvis. I have a theory here, and I have zero evidence to back it up, but this sort of 60s Elvis, what are the odds that this is a... I don't, major influence might be overselling it, but a large influence on what's going on in outlaw country. I should have written this down so I had a way to articulate it. But I was reading about some of the influences on Waylon Jennings and Willie Nelson, and all of them knew about Elvis, because how could you live then and not?
Sure. Well, and I mean, Waylon Jennings was Buddy Holly's bass player.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, I'm sure he knew Elvis. Johnny Cash knew Elvis. They did the Million Dollar Quartet together.
Yeah. And I need to work this out more. My gut says there's some kind of connection there. And I don't know if it's just that they're not in Nashville, right? Maybe it's just geographic, and they're kind of working outside the mainstream music industry. I think there's got to be something more to it.
I would put it more in. So I know Dwight Yoakam loves Elvis, like, in a way. I mean, sure. I love Dwight Yoakam, and he's probably my favorite country artist. And and I never got Elvis. I mean, I never really loved Elvis. I mean, he's fine, but I never really loved him. But Dwight Yoakam loves him, and Dwight Yoakam is part of this kind of like alt country Renaissance,
kind of
okay?
Like Neo Bakersfield.
Yeah, very much. And so I feel like that era of Elvis, as Michael describes it, sounds like Americana music today. I mean, no. The description of it, not the music itself.
Oh yeah, yeah. Because the music itself definitely does not.
The blending of various traditions into kind of a neo-traditionalist sort of thing sounds like the approach of alt country music today. And so I feel like maybe not so much outlaw country, which is still kind of rooted in country music particularly, but this more kind of expansive idea of Americana, maybe I can see some roots there in that era.
Well, if nothing else, Dwight Yoakam covered some Elvis songs.
Yeah. It's just lines, and yeah.
But
for sure.
I mean, if you haven't heard from Elvis in Memphis, it's probably most famous for a single that was not released on the album, which is Suspicious Minds. So yeah. If you think of what Suspicious Minds sounds like, that's what From Elvis in Memphis sounds like. And Suspicious Minds, I think, is one of the great singles of the late 60s. That's a wonderful song, which he sings with utter conviction.
Yeah.
Right.
No, I guess
I also go ahead.
I do all the songs you're talking about on that. I mean, I do really like those songs, right? And so, yeah. And I heard them in the 1980s on country radio. They would play Elvis on country radio, and so it is perfectly. And it was these songs, it's perfectly. Like, I think legitimate to include him in this episode.
Yeah, and that maybe I'm just flashing back to, my childhood days of listening to the classic country station, because they would play this era Elvis. They would not play the 50s era Elvis,
right.
Even though that sounds much more like Hank Williams,
right.
Than, 60s era Elvis.
Yeah, but I mean, this is country music. I mean, this is cut from the same cloth as those George Jones albums from the 70s,
right.
I think. I do want to talk about what may be the most lachrymose song ever written. It's called Don't Cry, Daddy. Do you guys know that song?
I don't think so.
Drop everything you're doing, listener, and go listen to Don't Cry, Daddy by Elvis. It is a song narrated by a recent widower who is clearly about to kill himself when his little daughter tells him not to cry. I'm going to recite rather than sing. Don't cry, Daddy. Daddy, please don't cry. Daddy, you've still got me and little Tommy. Together we'll find a brand new mommy.
Wow. Oh, Lord.
I love it. Like, it's a terrible song, objectively speaking, and his vocal performance is so over the top, and yet it's perfect. And the other one from that era that is pretty lachrymose, but I think he sells this one with his vocal performance, is called Kentucky Rain.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's standard on country music radio. Yeah,
that's a great song that he really hits out of the park with a vocal performance.
Yeah.
So, if you think you don't like Elvis, I would really suggest listening to that late '60s stuff, especially if you have a taste for the slightly overwrought.
And how different that sounds from anything else in the late '60s right now, right? I mean, that's on the radio at least. It doesn't sound at all like rock and roll at that point, and it doesn't really sound like country music exactly, right? But it's sort of some
the Blue Eyed Soul thing. I think the line between him and Dusty Springfield, who also has an album called From Dusty in Memphis.
Yeah, interesting.
I think that's a pretty straight line.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say something else about him.
His fourth period.
Yeah, fourth period is Vegas Elvis. I don't know as much about this. I think it's pretty. This is the point at which Elvis's drug addiction has taken over. The song people know from that era is Burnin' Love, Honka Honka Burnin' Love, which is a great song, and I don't care what anybody says about it. but I don't know that there's much else worth salvaging besides the what may be the worst album ever made, Having Fun with Elvis on Stage. You guys know about this album?
Is it where he's just sort of mumbling and telling jokes and stuff?
I think Colonel Parker, his manager, put it together, and it's a live album, but they've edited out the songs, so it's just his stage patter from the opioid period of his career.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Oh dear. Yeah.
So this, my first exposure to Elvis as a person other than just his music on the radio, was actually this period. Filtered through, what was the name of the 90s Superman? Lois and Clark?
Yeah.
So the editor in that, Perry White is this big Elvis fan in that. And he's got one of the episodes, this long monologue about how he got to go see Elvis in Vegas. And he was on drugs, and he was incoherent, and he was sweating profusely, and his suit didn't fit right, and it was the greatest experience of his life.
There's something to that, I think. The other thing to say about that period, we keep talking about Malcolm Gladwell, but the last episode of the most recent season of Revisionist History is all about Elvis and aphasia, I think it's called. Mm-hmm. He is attempting to sing Are You Lonesome Tonight, and when he gets to the ridiculous spoken word part in the middle on stage, he just can't stop laughing. And it's a really interesting episode about why that might be, and it'll give you a sense of who Elvis was on the inside, I think.
Huh. That's interesting. It's also interesting to me that that's the era that gets that the iconography comes from.
Like, it's a shame.
The joke Elvis. I mean, yeah, because the black leather jumpsuit of the late 60s is kind of cool still, right? You know, and he's in shape. You know what I mean? And but that whole like gaudy, you know, yeah, vests and stuff, like the hairdo and the glasses, that's what the impersonators, you know, draw from. And it's so strange to me that that's the era of Elvis that becomes really commemorated in the culture.
An era which I don't think most people like in any way.
Yeah, yeah.
Did I ever tell you that my band in college opened for an Elvis impersonator? It was very Spinal Tap. Yeah. The other thing to talk about, and Danny, you're bringing us into that, is Elvis as a cultural icon, which he is. Have either of you been to Graceland?
No.
No.
So, again, I'll point to my wife. Victoria loves Elvis. She's loved him since she was very small. And, in fact, when she was, I think, 5, Victoria was born in 1986, so this is 1991, 14 years after he died. She found out that he was dead and wept, like, uncontrollably, inconsolably. So she goes to Graceland when she's a little older. And, you know, if you're an Elvis fan, who wouldn't want to see his mansion? The most popular singer of 2 decades, really. How did he live? And you go there, and he lived like a white trash guy who suddenly came into a lot of money. There's carpet on the walls, and he has 3 televisions, and, you know, he shoots his TVs all the time. He really was white trash in a way that is about as appealing as it is unappealing, yeah, if that makes sense. You don't go to Graceland looking for grace, that's for sure.
Yeah.
You go to kind of gawk at the way this guy who had so much money had absolutely no taste. It's a little bit, as I imagine, Trump Tower to be.
Mm.
You know? He doesn't have the solid gold toilet, but it's
he didn't think of it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. He didn't have the imagination to have a solid gold toilet.
I love how you said this earlier. And this is sort of the final reason why I wanted Elvis on this episode about country music. He, I like your phrasing of, he really is the platonic ideal of what country singers either are or want to be.
Yeah.
Like he both in his personal story and in his popularity. I mean, he is the standard of everything except the music style.
But for about 5 years each, a decade apart, he really was the greatest. And I don't think you know, because the Elvis we remember is the Graceland Elvis, the Vegas Elvis, I think it's really important to remember that this guy actually once had the chops. He was the Beatles' favorite singer for a reason. You know, that wasn't them having bad taste. They had amazing taste. He was fantastic. And it's kind of a shame to see him literally die sitting on a non-solid gold toilet straining for a bowel movement.
Well, if you want to... redeem that a little bit. There's a movie called Bubba Hotep.
Oh, it's a great movie.
It's a fantastic movie.
I love that movie.
The premise is that Elvis is not, in fact, dead. He switched with one of his impersonators. So the impersonator died, but then all, you know, his trailer exploded and he lost all of the proof. He's now living in a nursing home that's being attacked by a mummy and is played by Bruce Campbell.
Yes.
Well, consider this. Elvis is probably dead now anyway.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
One other thing to say about him, I can't recommend this book highly enough. I love it. It's by a Georgia humorist named Louis Grizzard. I assume neither of you know him. He was pretty regional.
No, when I was in Emmanuel, I remember this, actually. Yeah, go ahead.
He has a book called Elvis is Dead and I Don't Feel So Good Myself.
Yes.
which is all about baby boomers kind of growing up. And he talks about what it was like to find out that Elvis was dead, and what's worse, that Elvis was 37 or 40 when he died. You know, not only did this man die, he aged, which is somehow worse. And so that book goes through all these ways in which baby boomer culture was better when they were young and worse now in the 80s when he's writing it. You know, it's a piffle, but I have always loved that book. But please, everybody, go listen to late 60s Elvis. Go buy From Elvis in Memphis and listen to it. You will not be disappointed. The first line of the album, I had to leave town for a little while. It's like the perfect metaphor for his career. He left town for a little while, but he's back. And he knows what you've been doing while he's been gone.
Well, anything else about these three guys? I don't even know how long this episode's going to be when we get it edited down. Anything else about these three individuals?
No, I think that they're a great menu of the options of country music in this era, right? And of the diversity in country music, in as much as it exists. It's not racial yet, but yeah.
Charlie Pride has
the exception of Charlie Pride, yeah.
Right, and Hootie, right?
Well, later.
Not exactly that era.
Yeah, and honestly, two of them, you know, Cash and Jones, their lives span most of the history of country music.
Yeah. Right?
It's only, what, the last 15, 16 years that they have not been in some way involved. Mm-hmm. Elvis, of course, is a much shorter life, but maybe more individually influential on American culture.
Yeah. I like to imagine, by the way, that if Elvis had lived into the 80s, he would have done a synth pop album.
I mean,
he would have recorded My Ding-a-Ling, I think. No, I'm just kidding.
Chuck Berry's only top 10 single. Consider that.
Well, on that note, we should close it out. Thank you both for coming on the show. I do appreciate this. And again, I have a lot of fun.
Blast.
Whether the listeners do or not, I don't know. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out the other podcasts in the family and get more info about our own show and our show notes on ChristianHumanist.org. Please also leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find the show. You can also like the Facebook page at Facebook.com/City of Man Podcast or get in touch with us at CityofManPodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal, and on behalf of Edward Song, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This is a man's cowboy song, the end of 100-year wars. The voices sound sad as they're singing along. Another piece of America's lost.